Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
After almost 18 months of war, fighting in Sudan is escalating. As seasonal rains end, the army is using intensified airstrikes and allied fighters to shore up its position ahead of a likely surge by Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary militia group. An uptick in fighting will aggravate an already dire humanitarian crisis in which famine has been confirmed and over 10 million people, one-fifth of the population, are displaced, more than anywhere else in the world. And now there's mounting evidence that regional powers are using the cover of aid to send weapons to the warring parties, perpetuating the fighting and the humanitarian crisis in the country. Well, today an Oireachtas committee will hear that the lives of 25 million people are hanging in the balance. Declan Walsh is chief Africa correspondent with the New York Times and is on the line now. And Declan has been covering this catastrophic civil war. Good morning, Declan.
Good morning, Claire.
So after more than 2 months of confirmed famine, what's the current humanitarian situation in Sudan?
Unfortunately, things just seem to be getting worse. So far, famine has been declared in just one part of the country, in a camp called Zamzam in Darfur. But aid groups say that in reality, the famine has actually spread to many other places. The difficulty is that there just isn't enough data to officially certify it yet. And that's really the most serious part of the crisis. But that also includes floods that affected just over 500,000 people in the last couple of weeks. In the last couple of months. There's been, as a result of that, a number of disease outbreaks. And that's against a baseline of about 11 million people who've been displaced from their homes since this conflict started, and probably up to 150,000 people who've been killed.
So what is the outlook then? What's expected in the coming months?
Well, right now we're just coming to the end of the rainy season, and what that means normally is an increase in the fighting. So, as you mentioned in your introduction, we've already seen the start of that, largely in the capital, Khartoum, where the army launched a pretty wide-ranging offensive last week. They pushed across the Nile, capturing several strategic bridges over the river, and captured territory that they had lost to their enemy, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitaries. They lost that territory about a year ago and they captured it back. We've also seen the army launch offensives in the southeast of the country towards the border with Ethiopia. But as I said, it is just the start of this fighting season. This time last year, we saw those paramilitaries, Rapid Support Forces, make huge gains across the country, sweeping across entire provinces, and we're expecting them to push back at the army. So, you know, as this humanitarian crisis deepens, the fighting is also exacerbating, which, apart from anything else, of course, just makes it incredibly hard for aid groups, any local or international groups, to reach people in those areas who need the help.
Mm-hmm. And the images that people may have seen coming from your own organisation, the New York Times, also the BBC and Sky, for many who remember what they saw back some 40 years ago now of the Ethiopian famine, those images that we're seeing now coming from Sudan are reminiscent of that. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Yeah, that's more than a fair comparison. All of the, you know, data points to the fact that this is likely to be probably the world's worst famine in the last, certainly since the Great Famine of Ethiopia in the 1980s that you were talking to, that you were referring to. So yes, it's extremely serious. But part of the problem is just that this is a huge country. It's the third largest country in Africa. You know, this conflict has eviscerated the capital, but it's also just spread to so many other areas. So it's very difficult to contain the sheer scale. The sheer numbers involved are incredible. This is a country of 48, 50 million people. As you said, about half of those people need food aid. And so far, international funds are lacking, but also access is a problem. So you combine all of those factors, and unfortunately, it's pointing to a situation that's likely to deteriorate over the coming months.
And then in terms of the political actors behind the violence, you've been reporting on this double intervention by a key US ally, the United Arab Emirates. What role are they playing in the conflict?
Well, the Emirates, the United Arab Emirates, are one of several outside actors who are playing a significant role in this conflict. On both sides, you've got countries that have been providing weapons to either side, basically in an effort to try and back a winner in this war. On the army side, you've got Russia has offered weapons, Iran has been providing drones, and several other countries. But by far, the most consequential foreign actor, if you like, has been the United Arab Emirates, because they've been supplying weapons for over a year now to the Rapid Support Forces in this covert or semi-covert operation they've been running, largely through bases in neighbouring Chad. The Emirates has been flying weapons and other military support into this airbase that's very close to the border, and they've been smuggling it across to the RSF. That's what our reporting has indicated. Not just weapons that have played a major role on the battlefield and in fact have helped the RSF in that sweep across the country, but they've also been supplying these very powerful Chinese drones that they're flying over the battlefield in support of the RSF.
And what is the ultimate goal of the UAE in doing this?
It's difficult to say. It should be said that officially the United Arab Emirates has staunchly denied this. It has stressed its diplomatic efforts to try and help end the war, it says. It has provided tens of million dollars to the same UN agencies that are helping victims of the war. But it seems that, you know, their motivations are probably rooted in the natural resources of Sudan. This is, as I said, it's a huge country with massive agricultural potential. And it's also crucially located on the Red Sea. Many of the foreign powers that are vying for a position in Sudan have even stated openly that they want to get control of a military base on the Red Sea, which, of course, right now is this part of this larger theater in the Middle East with, you know, Yemen on the other side. Further, it's close to Saudi Arabia. There are, you know, attacks on shipping going on in that water there. So it's this incredibly strategically located place. And it seems that for many of these countries, even though it's not always stated explicitly, there really is this strategic imperative. There's a sense that this country that's sort of wounded and in chaos is kind of up for grabs. And these different powers want to back a winning side so that ultimately their interests will be served when the war is over.
So how is America intervening and dealing with what the United Arab Emirates is allegedly doing? Have they been trying to influence a country that is their ally, the UAE?
Yes, it's been a bit of a double-edged sword for the Americans. They've played a very prominent role in the diplomacy in recent months. They've been trying to broker some sort of a ceasefire, but with no luck. And in private, American officials, including Vice President Kamala Harris, have, our reporting indicates, confronted the Emiratis in private with their own intelligence findings to say that, you know, that they have evidence that they know what's going on with this covert support to the RSF and that they would like it to stop. But on the other hand, we had a very prominent visit to the White House just a couple of weeks ago by the leader of the Emirates, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, who was warmly welcomed by President Biden at the White House. You know, the two countries, the United States announced that the Emirates was becoming a significant military partner for the US. There were a lot of business announcements, but they also very tellingly issued this joint statement about Sudan that was very disappointing to many people in Sudan because it spoke about that both of these countries had a shared interest in peace and that they wanted the war to end, but made no reference to the fact that the person who President Biden was sitting with came from a country that's actually seen as fueling the war.
It's an extraordinary situation as you describe it. And what is the prospect of either armed faction winning this war or maybe coming to some agreement where they manage to coexist peacefully?
For now, there's little sign that either side has the ability to win this war outright just because it's such a huge country. But I think what's even more important is that both sides still seem to firmly appear to believe that they can win. This conflict is just almost 18 months old now, and it appears that both sides seem to want to at least try and fight it out over the coming months to see if they can gain some sort of advantage before potentially sitting down for talks. But right now, there's no prospect of that.
Does the RSF have an advantage now? Because they are on the verge, aren't they, of controlling every major population centre in Darfur, which is just one region in the country, but a significant one.
Well, if you'd asked me a few, like at the beginning of the summer, I would have said they were absolutely the dominant force. The army has pushed back somewhat in recent weeks, so we're waiting to see what the response is. A lot of the fighting, the main focus of fighting in Darfur that remains is this city of El Fasher. The RSF has been laying siege to the city for the last 4 or 5 months. El Fasher is where there's this camp where famine has been declared. There's terrible human rights abuses taking place there in the background to the fighting. And yet the RSF has not managed to capture it. So there's still this one obstacle to complete control over most of Darfur anyway. And it remains to be seen how it plays out. But in large part, I think this conflict depends not just on the ability of the two warring parties, but also, unfortunately, on these for outside powers that are supplying them with weapons, particularly drones. Many wars in Africa now, as in Ukraine and elsewhere, are being determined by drones, and Sudan is no different. So both sides are receiving this weaponry, and it's becoming a battle of that as much as anything else. And the difficulty with that is that when you have all of these outside players involved, not only is that bringing this sort of flood of weapons into the war, but it's also greatly complicating any effort to try and achieve a ceasefire, because you've got to achieve, you have to accommodate the objectives and the needs, not just of the two sides in Sudan, but also of the people who are sitting behind them.
Declan, thank you very much for joining us. Declan Walsh, their Chief Africa Correspondent with the New York Times.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.